Retronauts is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows at podcast.hyperx.com. This week on Retronauts, we reveal a hidden use for the horse armor. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and this week we're talking all about Return to Monkey Island because, yes, we are back with another entry in our LucasArts podcast miniseries, and who would have guessed when I started this back in September of 2019 that we'd have a new Monkey Island game to cover. Yes, Return to Monkey Island came out just a few weeks ago as of this podcast launch date, and I think to date this is the newest game that we've ever covered on Retronauts. I might be wrong about that, but I don't think I am. But yes, we're very excited to talk about this, and joining me is my Monkey Island first mate. She's been with me through all five Monkey Island podcasts we've done so far. Who is here with me today?
Hi, I'm Nina Matsumoto, and I'm returning to Podcast Island.
It's true. We are setting sail for Podcast Island. I'm kind of stranded here. I've been here for about 12 years, so...
I'm like the Elaine in this case, where I keep popping in and out of your story.
Yes. Really, Retronauts is about my adventures. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's going to stay. But Nina is joining us today. And yeah, we're really excited to talk about this game. It came out. I had a few days to play it. And then I went to Vancouver to stay with Nina for a week. And we weren't, we forbid ourselves from talking about the game. So we are just bustling, about to explode with opinions about this game. And really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, we shared a few thoughts. But we kept saying we shouldn't talk about this. Save it for the podcast.
And I would say, just one more thing. And then I would, burn off podcast fuel that I need for this episode. But just let everybody know that the first half of this podcast will be us discussing generalities. It's going to be spoiler free. We're going to keep it spoiler free. So if you haven't played the game yet, you're interested in knowing what it's about, how it controls, what the UI is like, and just what the general like puzzle philosophy is like, we're going to cover that with no real spoilers. And then the back half of the game. Sorry, the back half of the podcast, rather, will be a discussion about the story of the game and the themes and the puzzles. And we're not going to cover like every puzzle and every character, but we're going to go over the general step by step of how the game plays out and what our thoughts are. But up front, I did want to know general spoiler free thoughts about the game. And we're going to give our like little reviews at the end. But Nina, do you want to start us off here? Like, what are your general thoughts about this game? Did you like it? Again, spoiler free.
Sure. Overall, I liked it a lot. I got used to the art style very quickly, and it was a lot easier than I expected it to be. But that doesn't mean it's boring. It just means it's very player friendly and the puzzles make a lot of sense. As you know, Bob, I played this game twice before you came up here to see me. So that was like twice in 2 days. And then I played it again last night, so I played it 3 times now, and that's because once you know the puzzles, it's very easy to blast through, just like the first 2 games. Speaking of, the story definitely retreads a lot of the first game, but somehow the first and second games, but it somehow doesn't feel like hackish or repetitive. The ending is controversial among fans already, much like the second game. We can talk about that way later. And overall, it just feels like a version of the first 2 Ron Gilbert games that's more optimized for the modern gaming experience or for those who aren't used to adventure games.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I have a few of my own thoughts in that I saw people, when this game released, I saw people saying, and I understand why they're saying this. They're saying, oh, which one should I play first? Or should I play the whole series first? Well, number one, I will say, don't play Escape from Monkey Island. Never do that. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a life or death situation, I would just choose death at this point after playing the game. check out our podcast about that. But yeah, people are kind of tying themselves in knots like, oh, what do I have to know? What do I have to play? And I say, if you've never played Monkey Island game before, if you've never played an adventure game before, you can start with this one. It is built for a modern sensibility. It is not built for the hardcore adventure gamer who has been playing adventure games for 30 years. I am one of those people, but the game also appeals to me for certain reasons. In the ways that it appeals to modern gamers did not push me away. But I say this is such a thoroughly modern take on the adventure game experience that it really feels like Ron Gilbert, 30 years after Monkey Island, set out the rules for adventure games. He's sort of like redefining his, like rewriting his manifesto to say, okay, now this is what adventure games should be like. I really feel like it is that revolutionary in terms of building off of the rules he set out for Monkey Island 1. How do you feel about that, that bold statement, Nina?
Yeah, I agree. Although I've seen some hardcore Monkey Island fans complaining that it's too easy. I just say, well, maybe the first two games were too hard, and it was for it was better for a time when people had more time to do things like that, because now we're constantly blasted with other forms of entertainment. And back then, you could just spend like a week stuck on a puzzle, and now you can't do that, especially with spoilers everywhere. There's an easy way to look up the solution to things. The game even gives you a way to do that. I'm sure that's also controversial, the fact that there is a hint book in the game, which is I think it's a first for a Monkey Island game, if I think about it. Yeah, there wasn't anything like that in Tails, because it's like a similar system they introduced in Thimbleweed Park by Ron Gilbert.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the details about that later. Yeah. But I mean, Monkey Island 2 would give you the 1-900 Star Wars number as a joke, saying if you're stuck, call the hint line. But yeah, I feel like as a guy who's played all of these Monkey Island games, who's played countless adventure games, I feel like this was, I won't say easy, but I will say the challenge was fairly moderate. But I was never bored. I was never disappointed in the puzzles. In fact, like it was a very addictive game that I couldn't stop playing, because solving the puzzles was satisfying. And even though they weren't as challenging as past Monkey Island game puzzles, I think that's because they were these puzzles are more intuitive, and the ways that the past puzzles challenged me were often unfair. And the way this game is designed really winnows away a lot of the variables of past adventure games and makes it a lot easier to kind of try out every possible solution. And of course, there's the hint book the hint system in the game. It's which is optional entirely. But yeah, I feel like if you're tying yourself in knots and thinking, oh God, I don't know anything about Monkey Island, people are talking about this, should I get through the games first? I will say no, because you probably won't get through the games. You'll probably get stuck. Or like you'll just get tired of playing five Monkey Island games in a row and then give up. I say start with this one and then play 1 and 2 and see where you want to go from there. And of course, we have our podcasts about the past games. You can always rely on those. But I will also say, and I'll go into more about this in the final thoughts. Like, I think in terms of design, this is the best Monkey Island game, period. And this may sound like sacrilege as a retro gaming podcaster, but these are people who define the adventure game genre, returning to it and showing everybody how it's done. And the 30 years of experience that Dave Grossman and Ron Gilbert have really have added up to like the sublime platonic ideal of the adventure game experience. And yes, I'm putting that out there right now. This is the best designed Monkey Island game, period. And I mean, maybe it's just because I just finished it and it's fresh in my mind, but I was constantly thinking about all the other games, all the other puzzles. I feel like in terms of design, this one is the best.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. The gameplay wise and mechanically, it's extremely solid. It's extremely friendly to the player without taking away the immersion too much. And that's also why I've been able to play it 3 times now, even though it's been out for just like 2 weeks. Because it's easy to go through, and it's still, even though you can like blast through it, it's still fun going through everything, going through the motions, because there's nothing about it that's tedious.
Yeah, I totally agree. They make so many choices that eliminate tedium from the adventure game, and we'll talk more about specific examples of those later in the spoilery section.
There's also casual versus hard mode, and we both played on hard mode.
Yes, and we'll talk more about what that means, but I think hard mode is like a misnomer. It's just, if you know what an adventure game is, that's the mode you should play. If you're at least familiar with like the mechanics and the grammar of adventure games, I feel like that's a good place to start off. But I also don't think it's that hard of a game. But if you're wondering, like, you know, it's a $24.99 game, I'm sure it'll go on sale during the holidays, and you might think, oh, is that too much? It's about a 12 to 15 hour experience, and I think there's a lot of replay value in the game, because I started a new game because I played on the Switch and now I'm playing on the PC version. I started a new game thinking, I just want to see how the PC version plays. And I found that just by playing about 90 minutes of it or an hour of it, I was like, oh, this is kind of a new experience. I mean, the general point of the dialogue is the same, but all this time I'm now choosing new options and I'm hearing new conversations, which was kind of the idea from the beginning with Monkey Island. It's like you can choose from like four different jokes, and when you play through the game again, you can choose a different joke for this exchange, and it really pays off in this game as well, I think. Friends, the holiday season is coming very soon, and short of petitioning the calendar people, there's nothing we can do about it. Let's face it, the holidays are that chunk of the year when time is at a premium. If I had more hours in the day, I'd knock out the rest of my Retronauts episodes for the year and then spend the next 10 weeks sipping festive spice rum cocktails and catching up on my vast, vast Wii U backlog. Unfortunately, 24 hours a day is all we're given, and if you're a small business owner like me, you know that's often not enough. But thankfully, Stamps.com exists to help fight the pure chaos that comes with shipping vast quantities of merch during the holiday season. Simply put, Stamps.com is the 24/7 post office you can access from anywhere, at any time, without having to deal with traffic or lines. Used by over 1 million businesses, Stamps.com can help you with all of your mailing and shipping needs. And you can do everything from your own computer and printer. No special equipment is necessary. Stamps.com also helps you save money as well as time, with up to 86% off USPS and UPS rates. And I haven't even mentioned all the features of Stamps.com that can help eliminate the stress of running a small business. Using the Switch and Save feature, you can compare different carriers and rates so you know you're getting the most bang for your buck. You can easily schedule a package pickup through the Stamps.com dashboard. And if you're running an online store, you'll be happy to know that Stamps.com works seamlessly with all major marketplaces and shopping carts. Folks, it's time to get ahead of the holiday chaos this year and get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up with the promo code RETRO for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter the code RETRO. That's offer code RETRO, R-E-T-R-O, at Stamps.com.
Yeah, that's a big reason why as soon as I finished this game the first time, I immediately started replaying it again, because I was like, I want to go back and choose different dialogue options and see what the character says in response. That's one of the most fun things about the first two games. There's a lot of replay value because of that, and also because of the trivia cards they give you in this game.
Right, and now because there are achievements, you can replay the game just to do the fun side things that reward you just for experimentation. And do you have all of them yet? I know you just got the speedrun achievement last night.
I do know that the last achievement is getting all the achievements. So technically, I have 9 Chivos to get through still. There are a lot. I was surprised.
Yeah, I was playing on the Switch version initially, and there are achievements in that version. Of course, they're only achievements that work within the game itself, because there's no achievement system, and things are popping up, and I was like, oh, these are not like achievements like push yourself to the test style achievements. It's like, oh, did you try doing this? Like a lot of fun, silly things in the game, which feels in the spirit of what Ron Gilbert wants his players to experience. I don't think he likes the idea of achievements. I don't think he likes the idea of a lot of modern games. That's why, I mean, this is not a modern joke, but that's why when you pre-order the game, you get Elder Scrolls style horse armor. I mean, that is now a dad joke, or a mom joke, if you prefer. It's like a 17-year-old joke. But yeah, we can tell what his issues are with modern games based on what he does with.
I actually like the
Chivos,
because one thing I loved about the first two games is you can do certain actions that don't really amount to anything. It's inconsequential. Like, for example, in the second game, there's someone you can free from jail, and you don't have to do that at all. You can just like leave them in there. But like something like that would be a Chivo in this game. And I like trying those kind of love actions. Getting an award for it is kind of neat. I'm not someone who usually chases Chivos at all. Like, I usually do not care. But I kind of want to try everything in this game, because it just kind of adds to the experience, I think. And there's another Chivo for finding all 4 solutions to a certain puzzle. Like, there's 4 ways you can complete something, and it gives you an achievement for that, like a little reward.
Yeah, I think it makes it better that none of the achievements are about performance, your performance as a player, because it's an adventure game, which makes them all like achievable. You conceivably can get them all. I mean, there's a game I really like, I try to get the achievements, and then I get to the ones where it's like, well, I can't perform well enough to actually do this unless I train or keep doing this over and over. So I'm not going to do this. But with Monkey Island, it does seem very possible.
Or it's something like collect 100 flags. And I'm like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yes. Thankfully, there's nothing like that in here. Although there's something like that in Thimbleweed Park, but mm-hmm. I think it is a joke when you're collecting all like the dust specks.
Yeah, I don't think I don't think there's a Chivo for that, is there?
I got achievements for collecting certain numbers of dust specks, but hey, this is not our Thimbleweed Park episode. That one is around the corner, yes.
Sorry, it's been a while since I played that one.
I can't wait to play that game again after playing this game. They're 5 years apart. I really want to see I want to remind myself of what Ron Gerber was doing in Thimbleweed Park, because I remember really enjoying that game, but I do like this one more. I want to talk about generalities. Okay, we're still in the spoiler-free section, but I want to talk about like what the UI is like, what the gameplay is like. Then we could talk about, you know, the graphics, the music, the voice acting. But I played on the Switch first, and then I played it on the PC, and the PC version controls exactly like you would think it was. You point and you click, and it's very straightforward. In the console version, you move Guybrush around with the control stick. And as you get close to things you can interact with, little circles will appear, and you can use the control pad or the L and R buttons to highlight those circles. Obviously the PC version is better. It plays in a higher resolution, and the screen is not littered with those little circles. I think it's a much cleaner presentation, but the Switch one is perfectly playable, and I think they did a great job of making it a console-style experience without making it feel like it's being hamstrung by the limitations of not having a mouse. But obviously the keyboard and mouse setup is ideal for this experience, but you're not really missing anything if you play it on Switch.
Yeah, I've heard it's really good on Switch too. I just can't play stuff like this on a console, since I grew up a PC gamer and this is a point and click game. It just feels wrong playing it any other way. I'm sorry.
Now it's a steer and push game.
No.
In the Switch version. that's straightforward. You click on things. You move Guybrush around by clicking on areas around the screen. In the Switch version, you hold down a button and use a control stick for him to run. In the PC version, you just double click and he'll run there. Like in past adventure games, walking across the screen could take a very long time, and even in the old Monkey Island games. And this one, moving around is so easy, and you're never bored moving to the end of the screen. It's all very fast and snappy, and very little time is wasted in moving around. So that's very good to see. Now, one of the more revolutionary things in this game is that there are no verbs, which kind of shocked me at first, because when I interviewed Ron Gilbert for Thimbleweed Park back when I was in the press, he was like, oh, adventure games, we lost something when we lost verbs, and I'm bringing back verbs. And he really was attached to the idea of verbs. And I was really surprised to not see them here. But then again, this is a modern experience, and I think verbs in the experience like this are really a thing of the past. So yes, no verbs you click on the screen to build sentences. You don't even get like a coin or like an icon, like in Curse of Monkey Island, there's a coin that pops up and it's like taste, touch, use, look at, etc. That's the same as in like Full Throttle and Sam and Max. It's usually called like the verb coin or whatever. In this game, it's way different in that every interactable thing naturally has a look at function built in. So like one mouse click will be the lookout button, or one button push on the Switch will be the lookout button. And oftentimes there'll be another way to interact with it that is usually specific to that item on the screen. So you can't choose from a list of verbs and then decide like, okay, I want to push the door. I want to, hit the door. I want to try every verb on this door. In this game, it'll be like, look at the door and then open the door. And those will be the two things associated with it on the screen. And I think that really does a lot to eliminate all of the unnecessary variables that can make an adventure game difficult in a way it doesn't need to be, because the game won't let you try everything on everything. And that was usually the way to, in a very tedious way, brute force every puzzle in an adventure game. Like, I'm going to rub every item on everything I see. I'm going to try every verb on everything I see until the game lets me progress. Well, your options are much more limited, which means the game is much more intuitive, I think, and in a very smart way.
I do miss trying to put my mouth on everything, though.
That is true. I did like the fun interactions that came out of like just trying an unlikely verb on an object. But that also led to a lot of adventure games being the one line of dialogue you would hear is, I can't use these things together, like 3,000 times throughout the course of a game. And they eliminate that entirely, because one other thing they do in this game is that you can't use every item on everything you see. If you pull out an item from your inventory and try to use it around the screen, you'll notice that most of the things you can interact with will now have like a little like cross sign through them, which means you can't use this item on this.
I really
appreciate
that.
Which I think is like, okay, yeah. I mean, that saves so much time. And often you'll be able to use an item on something and that won't be the solution, but that will lead you in the right direction. It's like, oh, you can use this item, these items together, but the item you're using it on needs to be in a different state first or something like that. And I thought that was very, very smart.
There's not a whole lot of combining of items in your inventory in this game, I've noticed.
Yeah, me too. Like we'll talk about the prologue, but they train you how to do everything in the prologue. And one of the things they train you to do is combining items in your inventory. And I think that's really only used for maybe like 3 or 4 different puzzles in a game with like 100 puzzles in it. I really feel like that's a minority in this game. And maybe that's just because it's unintuitive. It's something that people aren't thinking about doing, combining items in their inventory. And I think maybe that's why it's not a featured heavily in this game.
Mm-hmm. And there's not anything like, and we're going to bring this game up a lot, I think, Escape from Monkey Island, where you can pick up a bunch of useless prosthetic parts and put them together for no reason.
Yes. I mean, we're going to bring up Escape. And I don't think we have any big Escape fans out there, but it shows you a possible path for adventure games that I'm glad that we never took. And it also shows why this 2D version is so much better and why we didn't need the grime engine and where that was bringing us. But yeah, everything is just so much more intuitive. And I mean, it is 22 years later and things should be more intuitive. But Escape from Monkey Island will be like the Donnie Don't of the Monkey Island podcast from now on.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like Escape versus Return is like don'ts and do's. I think Escape used the Lua system, which I don't know if they've used that ever again since. I'm not sure what this new one is called. Do you remember?
It's called the Dinky Engine.
Okay, right, yeah.
And it is created by Ron Gilbert and somebody else. Yeah, it works very well. And very impressed by that. I'm thinking about other things with the UI that they've done with this game. Mostly like the interactions in a given area. Like this game is really about economy, I think. And there's very few rooms in which there's like a dozen things to look at and absorb all the text. Like that can be overwhelming an adventure game. Like I'm in a new room and I know I enjoy getting flavor text, but that means clicking on 20 different things and kind of camping out in this room for 25 minutes. Like they are about economy in this game, and there's not a ton of interactable objects within any given room, and most of the interactions are you asking someone in the same room about the object. I've noticed that instead of just a look at command, oftentimes it'll be like you asking someone in the same room, like, what is this? Or can I take this? Like, there's usually like a question associated with that object, not just give me a description.
And it's usually in a store, so it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. And one thing I didn't mention is that like the look at command for Guybrush, it's not like inspect object or look at blank. It'll often be like his immediate thoughts on the object, like yuck, or what is that? Like they really dress it up to make it more interesting. It would be very boring if it was just look at sign, look at parrot, look at pirate, things like that. They really tried to give you his inner monologue through the commands you're clicking on.
Yeah, and there's only, I think, 2 puzzles where you're stuck in one room or one location that you cannot, or one really small location you cannot leave. But getting out of there, it's pretty easy to figure out.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the bottle puzzles in this game. Where I mean, Monkey Island 1 and 2 did it, where you're in a room, you kind of can only use the things in the room, and it's kind of like a little escape room. Like, how do you find your way out of here? Other things in the game, the presentation I did want to highlight here, because we talked about this in our little preview discussion of the game in the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade adventure game podcast. But yes, there was a lot of hate for the look of this game initially, really upset Ron Gilbert. And I can say, like, I was not seeing it then, and I know it existed, and I'm definitely not seeing it now. Like, I'm reading threads about the game now that I finished it. I'm reading discussions about the game on, like, Reddit and message boards. not one person has said like, oh man, I love the game, but I wish the graphics looked different. Like that really is not brought up, because I think even if you had a negative reaction to what the game looked like, and I was a little put off. I didn't hate it, but I was like, can I get used to this? Yes, you will get used to it, because you end up realizing like the advantages of an art style like that. The backgrounds are very beautiful. And I think the main appeal for me, or one of the biggest appeals for me, is like I've never seen a 2D adventure game with accurate lip sync on the characters, and this one has it. And I think that actually adds a lot to watching little bobbing heads yakking back and forth at each other for like minutes on end.
Maybe you weren't looking in the right spots, because I went on the Monkey Island subreddit last night and I saw a lot of hate for the art style still.
Ooh, really? Okay. Yeah. I was not on the Monkey Island subreddit. I was on Something Awful.
Oh,
and
okay.
In the adventure game thread, they're very, you know, they're very complimentary about the graphics. But what did you think about the graphics, and did you have any issues with them? One thing I really like about them is that it changes up the visual language of an adventure game, where adventure games are usually about just staring at a fairly static screen. But with this art style, they often do close-ups of faces. They'll often do cutaways to people handing you things or taking things from you or showing you things. I think the graphics really kind of mix up the visuals to keep everything very interesting that you're staring at on the screen.
Well, people are spicier on Reddit, so maybe that's why. Yeah, I like the art style. I got used to the animation quickly. I said in the preview podcast about this that we did, I said I didn't like how they kind of like swayed and undulated as they're standing there. Some of the floatier animations, kind of puppety animation, I wasn't a big fan of. And it took me a little bit to get used to that. But once I was fully immersed in the game, it was not a concern of mine at all, because I was just like more concentrated on actually playing the game itself. The colors, I feel, were very reminiscent of Monkey Island 2. And like the big chunky angular exaggerations reminded me of games like Day of the Tentacle. So it felt like a mashup of the two styles, and it worked really well. I think one minor complaint I have is they're not very expressive in the face. Maybe it's because the previous game was Tales of Monkey Island, and that was very expressive. I mean, there's a whole puzzle based on facial expressions, so I think that's why it was like that. And now we're kind of back to what it was like in the first two games, which I normally don't mind. Like, I like the look of the first two games. The second one is like my ideal version of Monkey Island in general. But I think when you add voice acting to it, which the first two games did not have initially, of course, it feels weird when the voice acting is big, but you don't see much change in the faces. So I felt kind of a disconnect there.
Yeah, it's I agree with you in some parts that the visual language of Tales of Monkey Island was like the language of film and TV. Like the way conversations were shown to the player was as if you were kind of watching a movie where there's like reverse shots and things like that. In this, the visual language is that of an adventure game where you're just watching two little characters talking back and forth. And the downside of that is like the faces, everybody's got very tiny eyes and very small features in their faces, and those aren't as expressive as they could be. But I think the body language goes a long way, and the puppety nature of the characters, even if it puts you off a bit at first, it lets them do so many unique animations that would be just too time intensive to create if these were all sprites. Like Guybrush can do so many unique things that could only really be done on this scale through these puppety characters. And I think that really goes a long way. Just seeing all of the unique animations that go with certain actions that could never happen in an old Monkey Island game.
I actually didn't like the close-up very much. It really put me off at first. They're kind of randomly placed, which I can't criticize too much because it's like that in the first game as well. You see a lot of close-ups in like the scum bar, and then after that they just kind of forget about doing close-ups for some reason, unless you see someone like Elaine or Carla the sword master. And in this, well, like, so the cool thing about the first game, you see the close-up and you see the details in the face, you see what the characters are supposed to look like. It's especially helpful with Elaine because you're supposed to fall in love with her. But in this, when you see a close-up of the face, it just looks like you zoomed in on the sprite artwork. There's like not like a whole lot of extra detail there. So it made me think, why are we doing this?
I will admit that it can be awkward sometimes when you're not expecting it, just to see it like a giant face and then they cut away from it. But I think they were trying to think of ways to make the visual language of this kind of experience more exciting. It often doesn't work, but I did enjoy a lot of the cutaways to like not even the face stuff, just hands grabbing things and taking things, or
I don't mind the
them
hands.
Showing you a close up of an object. Yeah, like the faces don't often work because there's so little detail in the faces themselves. So it's strange to see them that big on the screen.
Especially since I played on, I played the PC version, and it's like huge on there. And it's just like big blocks of color mostly. And especially if you don't see it coming, it can be really jarring.
I guess it can be hard to like immediately read a face in how the, is it Rex Crowell? Is that his, is that the name of the art designer on this game? The visual designer, Rex Crowell?
Oh, I think so.
Yes, let's just say it is, and I'll look it up later. But his work, I mean, it's very expressive. It's very unique. But I think if you're just presented with like a close-up of a face and his style, it could be hard to immediately parse it, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a good solution to that, really, because I don't think his style would work very well if he added a bunch of extra details to it. It just works best as like a scene from farther away, like a full figure of a character. So maybe they just shouldn't have done it, is what I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do like the hand.
I mean, it doesn't happen that much.
I do like the hand close-ups, though, because one thing I really like about this game is everything feels very dirty and like grimy and corrupt, as a Monkey Island setting should be. And the hands kind of add to that. Every time you see a close-up of the hand, usually like the fingernails are cracked and dirty. Or the object itself is disgusting, like the scurvy dog in the prologue, for example. It was like really gross.
Yes, yeah. And the close-ups of objects are very nice. And I like in the beginning when, I mean, they even do that for jokes where in the beginning when you talk to the three pirate leaders, this is not a spoiler, by the way, because it's a Monkey Island game. There are pirate leaders. One of them is like, just like carving something in the table, and when they start laughing at you, they cut to her carving ha ha in the table, which is something that'd be much harder to do in like a sprite art style.
Like everything past the first two games felt too clean, I think, except for maybe Curse. Like Curse still had like hand-drawn artwork, so they could add a lot of details there, but all the 3D ones, even though I like Tails a lot, like it didn't feel as cluttered or dirty, because that's just like way, way more work. Like making a lot of modeling a lot of objects is a lot of work, and they didn't add like a ton of, I guess, grunge texture to things, and then like the islands they went to themselves are like more rich, I guess. Like Curse had Puerto Pollo, Escape had Lucre Island, and in this game the settings just felt more like what a piratey setting should be. There's stuff everywhere. Things are filthy.
I mean, you're never in one place for too long, I think, and that really helps mix things up. And more spoiler-free thoughts here. We could talk about some general things about the game. You mentioned trivia cards earlier, Nina. How did those work? Because it's a little fun like side game within the game. What are trivia cards and how do they function?
They just spawn randomly throughout the game. You pick it up. Well, first of all, you pick up a trivia card book. You need that to start the trivia game, pretty much. The cards spawn randomly throughout the game, and you have to keep picking them up and answering them in order to get new cards. So you can't just like hoard them. The trivia is all about like stuff from the past games, about the characters, the lore. Some of it is about behind the scenes stuff, like questions about Ron Gilbert and LucasArts. You answer.
Yeah, one of them was one of them I got right because I do this podcast was, when did David Fox start working at LucasArts?
Wow. See, I see questions like that. I'm like, I don't know. I don't remember these things.
You should ask your retro gaming podcast.
I'm not
going to
cheat. Well, I've gotten a few cards wrong already, but don't worry if you get if you answer wrong. It doesn't matter. There's no chivo to answer everything correctly without getting anything wrong. Because also, like the cards are going to keep respawning, and there are more questions than there are cards you can collect. So don't worry about that. I saw some people getting upset that, you know, once you like lose a card, like it's gone. But no, it will come back because the questions are also random, so it might cycle back to a previous question you had missed. And also, I this did happen to me where I answered a card wrong, and then later I got the same question. Some of the answers were different, actually. So I think eventually you can figure out what the correct answer is through process of elimination, pretty much.
Well, I mean, I wasn't expecting cruelty in a Ron Gilbert game, but I was afraid of what would happen if I got one wrong, and I only found out like way too late that nothing really happens. You should just keep trying to answer them. So in my current replay, I am trying to get all the trivia questions, or at least get all the achievements for getting like 50 of them correct or whatever.
Yeah, there's no way you can get, at least I don't think there's any way you can get all the cards in one playthrough, which adds to the replay value of this game. And you can't save scum. You can't like save and then answer, and if you get it wrong, like reload your game, because it's all saved in a separate file, I guess. And when you restart a new game, as soon as you pick up the trivia book, all your previously answered cards are in there, so don't worry about that either. Yeah, I was not afraid of answering wrong because I didn't think I would be punished for it. That's not what Ron Gilbert does.
So Monkey Island, Return to Monkey Island is a roguelike because there's that feature, and also Guybrush, he is a rogue. That makes sense, I think.
Yeah, it makes sense. There are also a few random puzzle solutions in this, much like the past games. Like, you can't just use the same map or like the same, I guess, password in some cases. But getting them is not a chore like say, the solution to Monkey Combat and Escape.
Yes. No, they would never do anything like that. And that was to be honest, like we talked about the game on the podcast, but that is not the worst thing about that game, which is shocking. I think I had fun figuring out Monkey Combat compared to like the sushi puzzle or whatever. These are all terrible memories of the pandemic. Well, history will probably agree with you and not me. But yeah, there's also, we talked about this up front, we hinted at it a bit, the hint system, rather, in the game, very much like Thimbleweed Park. I did not have time to look into this because I thought I would need it at some point. I think I used the Thimbleweed Park one a few times, but this one, there were a few moments where I was stuck for about 30 minutes to an hour, but I never resorted to using it. But from my understanding, it is very much like the Thimbleweed Park one in that it is like a chain of hints. Like, the first one will be like, have you looked in this area, or like try asking this person. And then as you work your way down the chain of hints, it will eventually tell you what to do specifically. And it's very smart about knowing where you are in the game and what you need to do. And I think that's, again, we talked about this in the preview podcast, but Dave Grossman said, when you're playing with a kid, if they don't get a answer in 2 minutes, they're going to go to the internet to look it up. So we want to have our own in-game internet lookup system. Otherwise, people are going to be leaving the game too much.
Yeah, please don't use a walkthrough online. Just use the hint book. It's very good. I actually did use the hint book twice. They both happened in Act 4, which is a very long act. There's lots of things to do. I used it once to confirm I had the right idea of battle puzzle, because I was trying something, it wasn't working, and I thought, like, am I at least kind of on the right path? And I used a hint book to confirm that. And the second time, I actually went too far, and I ended up seeing the solution to the puzzle. So if there's one thing I would fix about the hint book system is it should warn you, like, hey, the next hint is actually the solution. We're just going to tell you what to do. Are you ready for that? And I would have said, no, let me figure it out.
Yeah, thankfully you're not punished or mocked for using it. It's very nice and friendly. It's not like the baby book or whatever for dummies. It's just like, hey, we want you to get through this game. Because if you don't, the internet exists. You're going to look it up anyway. So just stay in the game. And, you know, here's a rewarding way to kind of steer you in the right direction. I think it's very well done. A few other non-spoilery things this game does I want to talk about is I didn't use this feature much because I was playing on the Switch, and I would just put my Switch to sleep and then pick it up again. But if you exit the game, and this is optional, when you restart it, due to the framing device that we won't talk about until the spoiler section, there's a framing device in the game. And if you leave the previously on feature on in the game, when you restart it, you will have characters sort of going back and forth as to what happened so far and what you currently need to do. And That's not completely necessary, but I did it once and I was like, they're being very specific about where I am in the game and what I have to do. So they probably wrote a lot of extra dialogue just for these recaps that most people probably won't even see, and some might even turn off in the options menu.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I also had that feature turned on, but I didn't need it, so I never saw it. I thought they would just give you like a text summary of what you last did or something. That's cool that they made it actual dialogue. That was taking a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm tempted to just keep restarting and exiting the game just to see how much dialogue, because there has to be like over an hour of dialogue just recapping things that you've done or need to do in the game.
I'm wondering now how long you have to lead the game alone for before they give you a summary. Because I went back to a save file from like a week ago and it still didn't give me anything like that.
That's really strange, because I just tried to, you know, end and restart my game, you know, just to try it out, and they give it to me immediately.
I think
it's intended to be used like whenever you exit the program and then restart it again. I think they give you that recap if you have it turned on.
Hmm. Maybe somehow I've constantly been in the game for like the last 2 weeks.
Maybe.
No, I think
maybe
I'm
you're just
sure
like slamming your way past that. If you're playing on Steam, yes, I have to assume, unless you're not like turning off your computer. So up next, one of the last things I want to talk about is the special writers mode in the game, and that is turned off by default. You might be wondering, what is this? You might even miss it if you just jump into the game when you play it initially. And what that is, I haven't seen much of what that adds to the game, but I have seen enough to know that it's not necessary, but it is really cool for a second playthrough, because I mentioned it before, what I like about this game is it's all about economy. They're not taking anything away from you, but they're trying to make a very streamlined experience where characters say just enough. You're not constantly in these branching dialogues with people. It's not overwhelming just to hear everybody talk. But when you jump into the writer's mode, you'll immediately notice like, oh, this person has more dialogue. And oh, these characters are introduced before I would see them later in the game. And what they add isn't necessary. But I think like for a second playthrough, it is really cool to see like, what they thought they wouldn't need and what they assume would just be flavor that might be a little too much for a player up front.
Yeah, I played it without that mode on the first time, then I turned it on to play it the second time. I didn't notice too much of a difference, so I would say to first-time players, just play with it on so you don't miss anything.
Yeah. I mean, nothing is being taken from you if you have it off. But if you want to get like the most out of everything they wrote for the game, you can leave it on. But it's a neat that they have that off initially, just to be like, well, here is the ideal experience. We realized that we were self-indulgent. We gave this person too much to say, or you didn't need to see this character here first. And I like them kind of taking a second pass at their work, but letting you see the rough draft first. I think that's really cool.
A couple other things about the game system. There's a to-do list, which is taken from Thimbleweed Park. I didn't use it past the tutorial part where they kind of tell you to look in there and complete all the tasks you can complete in there because I blasted through the game. But it is a good way to remind you of what you were doing last and what you need to do still.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Actually, I didn't really use it until chapter 4, which, again, no spoilers, is a very big chapter with a lot of locations. But, I mean, Ron Gilbert's usually giving really good at giving you, like, here are 3 things you need to do. Here are 4 things you have to need to do. Here are 5 things you need to do. And it's all, like, a tight collection of related things that are interdependent on each other. And the to-do list just lets you know, like, the tasks associated with those, with the more major tasks. And like I said, in chapter 4, I did rely on that just to be like, there's so much to do. What haven't I done? And I think one of the unchecked check marks was one of the things I forgot the game told me I needed to do. I was like, oh, right, I have to go see him again. Okay, so in that case, the to-do list did help me, and it might have added like 20 minutes to my gameplay if I would have been like, all right, I have to go to all these locations again and talk to everybody again and see who I'm missing or who I forgot I needed to help.
And also casual versus hard. So I did a speed run kind of this game just to get the achievement. That's you have to finish the game in 2 hours or less. I did that last night, and I played it on casual mode because obviously it's faster that way. It definitely gets rid of a lot of puzzles. Like, in order to avoid spoilers of actual puzzles, I'm gonna make some up. Like, let's say you have to give someone a hot dog. You acquire the hot dog and you give it to them. They might say, "Hey, there's no ketchup or mustard on this. I need both of those." So you have to go get them. But in casual mode, they would say, "Oh wow, thanks for the hot dog. Good thing I had the condiments already." Yeah, there is actual extra dialogue recorded in that way. And like let's say you have to you want to pick up an item, but an animal is guarding it. Like in casual mode, that animal just wouldn't be there. So if you really want to just see the story, if you really want to just take in the lore, casual is good. But otherwise, I would just say playing on quote-unquote hard mode, because it's not even that hard.
Yeah.
The casual mode kind of takes away some of the fun of the game, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It feels like the puzzles were designed first, and then casual mode was them taking away steps of the puzzles. For something like Curse of Monkey Island, it feels like the game was designed first, and then they decided to add steps for a harder mode. Like, yeah. In this case, it feels like the puzzles in the hard mode are designed as intended, but something like Curse, it feels like the hard mode in that game is like, you just overcomplicated these puzzles to the point where some of them aren't as fun as they used to be.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much was taken away in casual mode, but it's good for getting the speedrun achievement.
Yeah, and especially if you just want to see the story, if you just want to see the characters. But again, we both think the game is not difficult, but it's still very satisfying. And especially if you have played one of these games before, or if you at least know what a Metro game is, I think you won't be lost or in over your head, because all of the ways this game doesn't like to hold your hand, but it also makes things very intuitive, and it eliminates a lot of just like rubbing against things and just trying every option, because it won't let you try every option. And I think that leads to a very playable game. Some other things we need to cover before we get to the spoiler section is that this game has a really, really good soundtrack. And it's written by the only three people who can do it, and that's Michael Land, Clint Bajakian, and Peter McConnell. And I will say that, like, I didn't really notice it while playing too much, and I think that really speaks to just how perfectly it fits in. Like, I feel like if anyone else were to make the music for this game, it would sound off to me. But upon my replay, I was really taking notice of the songs. And yes, some of them are remixes, of course. You're going to get that in a Monkey Island game. Every one of these does it. But there's a lot of very good original tracks, too. And they do their own, like, primitive version of iMuse, and that, you know, different areas within a larger area will have variations on that area's theme. And they don't have the sophisticated tools they did in with Monkey Island 2, but it still is pretty effective, and not a lot of games do that.
We're here to announce a special deal for all of our Retronauts listeners. If you've had your eye on any of the pink variants of HyperX gear, you can save 15% off during the month of October by using code HXPN over at HyperX.com. Get yourself an elegant white and pink Cloud 2, or a metallic pink Ally Origins 60, or any of the other pink peripherals on the site. Once again, head over to HyperX.com and get 15% off all pink gaming products with code, all caps, HXPN.
I was so happy to see that return. It is still, like you said, it's not like exactly like how it was with the IMU system in Revenge, but it was still a nice touch, and I really appreciated that. The part where that's most noticeable is when you're in the scum bar and you go see the three important pirates, and you get a bit of like the guitar version of it. That's where I notice it the most. Other parts are more subtle, I think.
Yeah, they're definitely subtle, and it feels like within the game, they're playing like two tracks at the same time, but they decide like which one to raise and which one to lower completely. That's really the extent of the music system here. And it does, like, I forgot to look at the credits again. It does feel like this is live recorded music, or they do a really good job of faking it, because I was playing it with really good headphones and listening to the music, and you can hear like the breaths taken in before someone blows into an instrument.
Oh, wow, really?
On the tracks. And you can hear like fingers on frets and stuff.
Wow.
I was playing like really good headphones on, and maybe you can fake that now. You probably can fake that, and then that's great. But it's like it does sound like a real performance. And yeah, these guys, they always do a really, really good job.
Ooh,
at Monkey Island Music, and I'm happy.
Do you think you can fake that stuff now? Just like auto add someone taking your breath before blowing to their wood instrument?
I'm sure they probably figured it out like 20 years ago. Just like
creepy.
We have 10,000 procedurally generated inhales we can add before this woodwind starts blowing. But hey, you know what? It sounds cool, and I liked it. But yeah, these guys, they knocked it out of the park. And when selecting music for this episode, I was able to listen to it, you know, without being distracted by the game. And I was like, oh, man, this is so good. And I'm so glad there's another Monkey Island soundtrack, because even with Escape, you know, Take a Shot, we mentioned it again. The one redeeming feature of that game is like really, really good soundtrack that I can just listen to while I'm writing or doing something and not think about playing Escape from Monkey Island. So, yeah, kudos to the composers on this. And finally, finally, you're allowed to go for it.
I can't think of any new songs, though, that stand out to me. Like, if you ask me to hum a new song from Return, I can't think of any at all.
I think it's because the old themes were etched into our child minds, and now nothing sticks.
But Tails had a couple of new tracks that stood out to me. And I'm not getting that this time. It's not a complaint or anything. It's fine. I just can't think of anything other than... like the themes we've heard before that really stood out to me.
Yeah, I mean, no song in any area stood out as like bad to me. Like, oh, this is not a good song. Like, it all like blended in so well. I didn't really notice it. And I think that really speaks to how well these guys know how. I mean, think about these three. They've had to make like 500 songs, like Caribbean sounding songs, in their career. There's only so much you could do within that like framework of, you know, instrumentation and style of songs. I feel like they're still doing it, and it must be very difficult to still come up with new material on your sixth Monkey Island experience here.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm just happy to hear the old things again. I think that's what we're all expecting.
Yes. Nostalgia's here, although I will say this game is not entirely relying on nostalgia, and I'm very happy about that. We can talk about that more later in spoilers. But finally, voice acting. We get returning actors, of course. Dominic Armato is Guybrush. There's no other Guybrush. We couldn't have anyone else play him. And I will say my thoughts on this performance is it is his best Guybrush performance. He actually does not do a ton of acting. He was doing a moderate amount of acting in the late 90s, early aughts. He really dropped out of acting to pursue other interests. He only is coming back to do Guybrush. And I think this is his best take on the role so far. He knows the characters. Every intonation feels right to me. And he feels very, very confident. And yeah, that's my thoughts on Dominic. So he does a great job in this game.
Yeah, he's good. I've always thought he was great as Guybrush, and this game is no exception. The cast in this game, like the cast of characters, is a lot more diverse in the other games, and there's especially more female characters. I really noticed that, and as a result, there's more female voice actors. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I mean, it was always a fairly diverse game, even though it stars a white guy, like more diverse than most adventure games. But
yeah,
this time around, also, I noticed it's like all the casting, based on what I saw and the names I looked up, it all seemed like the person is a black person, they're played by a black actor. And if there's like an Asian character, they're played by an Asian actor. It's all like racially appropriate casting, which not always the case.
There are Asian characters. There are Asian characters, finally.
There are Asians. I can't remember if there have been any in Monkey. Have there been any in Monkey Island? Any Asian characters?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think I would have noticed if there were.
Yes. Yeah, there's at least like two Asian
characters.
At least
two, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised to see that, you know, the racially appropriate casting was in place. And we also get a lot of other returning people, like Alexandra Boyd as Elaine. She is our proper British Elaine. She's not doing a lot of acting lately, but she will come back to be Elaine. And again, the American Elaine was the fluke, the Escape from Monkey Island fluke. Someone decided, like, make her American, which always felt wrong to me. And I like her raspy, playful voice in this game. She's great.
And we have the best version of Stan, which we did bring up in our preview podcast about it, but I was happy to hear him, and this might be
yes
the best version of Stan ever.
Gavin Hammond as Stan. He was only Stan in Tales of Monkey Island. So far there have been like four Stan actors. And unfortunately, like the guy who played Stan in Curse was just doing what he was told to do, doing the voice the directors wanted him to do. But unfortunately, they placed that version of Stan in the remakes of 1 and 2. So he's like the dominant Stan voice. But Tales of Monkey Island went with a very different approach, as did Escape. And I think those are better. But yeah, he is a great Stan. And I'm glad it's not the game show host voice Stan from Curse in the 1 and 2 remakes.
Introducing the new HyperX Cloud Stinger 2. The Stinger 2 is a refined evolution of the classic Cloud Stinger and keeps the fan-favorite 90-degree rotating ear cups, comfortable memory foam cushions, and the swivel-to-mute microphone. It also features 2 years of DTS Headphone X activation for upgraded sound localization, all while keeping the great price of the original Stinger. That's right, get the new Cloud Stinger 2 for only $50. Now isn't that nice? Available online at Amazon, Best Buy, Walmart, and of course, HyperX.com.
And we also have a new LeChuck, and that is Jess Harnell, a very, very, very experienced voice actor. Earl Bowen was LeChuck for everything until now, except for part of Tales. We'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, Earl Bowen was retired when they made Tales of Monkey Island. They basically got him for the last chapter. He was not LeChuck before that, but he does play LeChuck in the last chapter. And I think they'd approached him for this and he's like, yeah, you know what? I'm too old for the role. I really like doing it, but you know, I'm retired now, but you have my blessing to recast. So they at least approached Earl Bowen, a great character actor. And Jess Harnell, most famous for playing Wacko on Animaniacs, although he's done a million things since then. My only complaint was like, he sounds too young. But it's a good performance. But then I looked it up and he's like, oh, he's actually older than Earl Bowen was when Earl Bowen was cast as LeChuck.
Oh, really? How much older?
Yeah. He's like 58 and I think Earl Bowen was like 53 or 54.
Wow, okay.
So technically, yeah, Jess Harnell, I mean, if you look at him, he looks like he just stepped out of a Motley Crue van. He does not look like a 58-year-old man.
Yeah, I was surprised when I Googled him.
Yeah. Like, but yeah, he is older than Earl Bowen. I think Earl Bowen just grew up in an era where everyone was like smoking and just chugging mm-hmm. whiskey all the time. And he's got that really deep, raspy voice that made LeChuck sound a lot more terrifying. But yeah, Harnell, a good choice. I think a good replacement. You really can't get someone like Bowen again, but I think it's a good replacement from a voice actor who knows what he's doing in the game.
You definitely notice
this character.
You definitely notice that LeChuck sounds different in this game, and it took me a little bit to get used to it. But now I'm like totally okay with it.
Yeah. And yeah, we have to get to the spoiler discussion, but those are just a few of the notable ones. Any other ones you want to highlight, Nina? I mean, everyone does a good job. No one sounded off to me. And yeah, I think this was a very well cast game. And like the people you would expect to return do return. Like Danny Delk is, yes, Murray's in the game. That's not a spoiler. He was in like the preview teaser of it. But yeah, like they tried to find the right people. They even got like very small roles cast as they were cast for the remakes over a decade ago. Like Rob Paulsen plays the lookout, I believe, as he did in the Monkey Island remakes from the early 2010s.
Also returning is Neil Ross as Wally, and he also does a good job, although because like naturally he's much older now. I first heard him on the Spider-Man animated series in the 90s as Norman Osborn / the Green Goblin, and Wally just he sounds a little Green Goblinish, I think.
Oh really? I don't have that connection in my head. I was happy to see Wally again, and maybe this is a spoiler. I'm sorry. I mean, this is the return to Monkey Island. You're going to see a lot of characters you've seen before, but yeah, it was good to see him again because I don't believe he was in Tales. But they got the same actor again because he just did Monkey Island 2 and Curse and this one, I think. I don't think he was in Escape, although I've, again, blocked out most of my memories of that game. So any other thoughts about the generalities, Nina, before we leave the spoiler-free section?
No, I'm ready to talk spoilers because that's mostly what I want to talk about.
Awesome, let's do it.
Previously on Chat of the Wild.
But what we have to do is there are these seeds in these little holes that we have to put specific water on mm-hmm. to make them grow up. And we get the Mario sound effect for the vines going up.
Yes.
Like it's what exactly is the sound effect for Mario that they use?
Can you guys just do that simultaneously again? Thanks.
Chat of the Wild. Breaking down Zelda and Zelda-like games, one dungeon at a time. Wednesdays on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Take a time machine back to before the world went to hell, around the year 2000.
The 80s and 90s were so rad.
The movies, the music, the TV, the games, that's what I want to talk about.
If you're cool enough,
join us and listen to Less Than 2000, because that's all we talk about.
Adam and Chad live
Less Than 2000.
Now part of the
HyperX
Podcast Network.
So here we are on the other side of the podcast, and now you're in the spoiler zone. We're going to assume that you finished this game, and if you haven't finished it, please do, because it's only about 12 to 15 hours, so very, very digestible.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
Yes, although I think it's the perfect length for an adventure game. By the end, I was like, okay, I'm ready for this to end, and it did, and I was happy for the experience. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest spoiler bomb you want to throw out there, Nina?
The biggest spoiler bomb is you start off as Boybrush, who turns out to not be young Guybrush, but Guybrush's son. And the whole game is framed as Guybrush telling his son this story of him finding the secret of Monkey Island.
Yes, it's not really giving you a resolution to the Monkey Island 2 ending. And that's what people really wanted. The beginning and ending of the game are really Ron Gilbert being a little stinker in a way I kind of like.
Yeah.
I understand that
people are mad
about this.
Well, on Reddit they're mad. Yeah.
Yeah, in a way I understand. In another way I'm like, let's just chill out, everybody, because this is the storytelling and the themes and just the sense of design in this game. I think like Tales of Monkey Island, even though Dave Grossman worked on it, it does feel like a very sincere take on the series by fans. And it largely was created by fans, and a lot of fans worked on it. This feels like, and it is, people who created it coming back to it and saying, don't take it so seriously, guys. We're just having fun here. And that's what mm-hmm. the beginning and the ending feels like. Because they don't have the distance from the game that we do. They're very close to it because they're the creators of it. And yeah, the intro of the game is, okay, yes, this is where the second game ended. Somehow Guybrush and LeChuck are children now. What happens next? Well, what happens next is like, no, there's another rug pull here. You find out that after a little tutorial prologue, this is Boybrush. Chucky is his friend. It's not Lil Chuck as a child. And you do a lot of little tasks that teach you how an adventure game works. And then you catch up with your dad. And it's a very Princess Bride style, telling a little kid a story kind of setup.
So they never say Boybrush in the game. You have to turn on the captions, or the captions that show you the names of the characters speaking, at least. Or I guess the script. Because you can go back and read the script at any point in the game, which is also a good accessibility
right.
feature.
That's a feature we didn't mention.
Yeah.
That feels like it's taken from Japanese adventure games.
So I've only
seen them in Japanese adventure games.
Boybrush isn't like a nickname. Is that? Do you think it's literally his name is Boybrush?
I think it is. And I think they named him that because if you look at the text before you meet Guybrush, if they called him something different, you'd be like, well, if his name is like Alan or something, this isn't Guybrush. What's going on? But
yeah.
If they call him Boybrush, you could be like, well, this is Boy Guybrush. That's their little joke. But then you meet up with Guybrush at the end of the prologue and you're like, oh, no, this is his boy. I'm literally Boybrush.
Did you see that twist coming? Because I didn't.
I did not, and it I was smiling
me.
When I saw. Yes,
I was kind of disappointed
when you see
in
Guybrush
for becoming a dad. I'm like, oh no, they did this to you too.
you know what?
Male character has to become a dad.
It's true, but I think this is the one dad game where it's tolerable because A, the dad loves his wife, who
yes.
B, is not dead.
That's true.
So I feel like it's the one tolerable wife, dad game. And I think a lot of it is because I don't believe Ron Gilbert has children, but Dave Grossman became a father between Tales of Monkey Island and this game. And it feels a lot of like very observational. I feel like a lot of this is coming from him.
It also helps that, like, you do see flashes of Boybrush throughout the game when it cuts back to the framing device. But it's not like he's prevalent throughout the game, and it's not like you play as Boybrush. That would have disappointed me.
No. No, yeah, it's not like Metal Gear Solid 2. You play as Boybrush until you find out you're not Guybrush. That's very smart. But, I mean, the prologue, we can just skim through it really quick. This is not going to be like us doing a talk-through Let's Play of the game, but... this is for people to teach them how to play an adventure game. It's like, here's how you move the character. Here's how you run. Here's how you use items. Here's how you talk to people. Here's what the to-do list is. Basically, the first thing you do is get a scurvy dog to eat with Chucky, your friend. And then you meet a little know-it-all little girl who's your annoying friend, and she gives you a list of things to do. And by doing that list, you learn how an adventure game works. And I think it's not the most exciting way to play this, to start off a game if you are a veteran adventure gamer. But it is exciting at first to be like, well, what's going to happen now? How are they going to follow up the Monkey Island 2 ending? And then you find out they don't, but it doesn't matter.
Well, I like that they give you a to-do list at the very beginning there, just to teach you that it exists, but you don't have to do everything on the to-do list. It's totally optional. You can just like blast through to the next screen and meet up with actual Guybrush.
I thought you had to do everything. So I guess if you're a seasoned adventure gamer, you're like, I get it. You can skip all this. That's really good to know.
Mm-hmm. I only know this because when I first played it, I tried to leave that area without having done everything. And Chucky says, are you sure we want to... are we sure we've done everything we wanted to do here? We may not be able to go back. And I thought, oh shoot, I guess I'd better finish the to-do list. But yeah, it's totally optional. I like that they give you like a huge rambling from the girl character, I think Dee Dee, I think her name is.
About I think so, yeah.
An anchor or just anchor history, just to teach you the mechanics of skipping dialogue. And it turns out all those anchor facts are fake. None of it is true.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, because when I played it again, I actually listened to all of it, and I'm like, I guess this is true. I don't know. I was hoping I'd get like an achievement for listening to it all, but I didn't. So that's just a tip from you guys. You can skip her dialogue. But yes, you as Boybrush, you were asking your dad, like, oh, tell me about the time you found the secret of Monkey Island. You'll never tell me it before. I want to hear about it. And that's how Guybrush launches into the story of his return to Monkey Island, which... if you look at the scrapbook that is on the menu screen, it does tell you like all of these things happened before this Guybrush adventure, but it is not really relying on continuity, which I really, really like, because with some of these Monkey Island later games, the stories get too convoluted. They think about continuity a little too much. And this one is just like, let's just say Guybrush has done all these things and now he's doing other things. And all that you need to know is that some of the people he's met, you meet on this journey, he's met before. This game, I think... Go ahead.
The scrapbook feature is very good, but I like that it's like totally optional. You don't need to know all the things that he went through at all. And I like how somehow LeChuck has returned. They don't explain like... why he's there, why he's still, like, in zombie mode, kind of. Or is it demon LeChuck? No, it's more like a zombie LeChuck. Because at the end of Tales...
Yeah, they didn't come up with a new LeChuck form for him in this game.
At the end of Tales, they destroy his, like, physical and spiritual self. But then Morgan retrieves the spirit or essence of LeChuck and takes it to the Voodoo Lady. And that's when you last see LeChuck. And they don't say, like, oh, the Voodoo Lady resurrected him or anything like that. He's just back.
Yeah, and I mean, Guybrush mentions characters that don't appear in this, so it's all canon, but at the same time, this is not, I mean, it isn't and isn't a game for Monkey Island nerds. It is a game for Monkey Island nerds in that you're happy to see the characters you like, and you're happy to hear the music you like, and you're happy to be in the setting you enjoy. But if you don't know anything about these characters or the previous games, you can still enjoy it as like meeting all these people for the first time, because this game is not full of like elbow nudgy moments for Monkey Island fans. It's not relying on that, at least.
Yeah, they bring back a bunch of characters, but not all characters. There are some characters I was hoping to see in here that didn't make it, like Meat Hook and Captain Smirk, especially Captain Smirk, because you don't see him past the first game ever.
I assume he's dead. I just kind of assumed that.
It just would have been cool to see him again, yeah. Just because he's never brought back.
They were very selective with who they chose to bring back. And the story is very simple in a way I enjoy. It's like LeChuck is launching a voyage to Monkey Island, and you hear about this and you're like, no, I'm the guy who goes to Monkey Island. I'm going to do this. And that's essentially the point of the game. It's just like, okay, do the things that you did before, but different. And the first chunk of the game is essentially, well, this game follows the same kind of formula as Monkey Island, in that it's like in the beginning of Monkey Island, you have to find a map, a ship, and the crew, although you find different things in this one. And then the second chapter is you inside of a ship in like a bottle puzzle, solving puzzles there. And the third chunk of the game is basically you on Monkey Island. But then it goes beyond that. So the fourth chapter is essentially their own little mini version of Monkey Island 2. And then the fifth chapter is like another LeChuck bottle puzzle that usually ends most of these games. So they are relying on previous structures, but they're doing new things with them.
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, it does feel like mashing up the first two games together, which is cool. But it also slightly disappointed me that it was such a retread of those two games. I was just hoping for something a little bit different.
I think it did enough in that it asked different things of you, and the ways you got around were different, and it was also much easier to get around. Because if it was just like, okay, find a map, a ship, and a crew, and you did that, you did the sword fighting trials again, you did all the same things but different, I think that would be really disappointing. But they find new things for you to do, and in fact, this is a spoiler section, there is no insult sword fighting in this game, and it would have been perhaps a little tacky if they were like... Yeah, I mean, that just shows you we're not going to do everything the same again, because it might be a little tedious. Like, well, here's our new take on insult sword fighting. You've done it five times before, but here's a new thing we come up with. And they kind of make you think they're going to do that. It's like, well, the new version is like a comeback to a comeback, and they could build off of that. But they realize like, oh, we've done this before and we don't need to do it again.
Yeah, when LeChuck pulled that on him, I thought, oh, cool, this is a new system we're going to have to learn. But then it didn't come back. I was slightly disappointed that there was no sword fighting. But whatever.
I was okay with it just because they had done it so much. And it's like, why beat yourself up to come up with a new version if it might not be better just to do it? And the first chapter is basically you need to, instead of getting your own ship, you're going to sneak onto LeChuck's ship in order to, go to Monkey Island, get the crew to mutiny and, you know, disrupt LeChuck's plans. And the main things you need to do to get on the ship, it's like a puzzle of twos, although there are many things you have to do within that chain to get the things. You need a mop, and you need an eye patch to transform you into like an undead looking guy, so they'll let you on the ship, because LeChuck does not want to hire Guybrush. And those are essentially the two things, with many puzzles dependent on them for you to get those two things. And I think it wasn't a puzzle of threes it starts off with. Instead of a map, you get a mop, which I thought was kind of funny. And all your friends on Melee are there, and most of them. And I love that the nighttime setting of Melee, even though, yes, we're returning to Melee again, it's much better than the return to Melee in Escape from Monkey Island, which is where that game begins. And that was even a nostalgia piece in 22 years ago.
The mop is the thing that has four different solutions. There's four items you can use as the head of the mop. You can use any of them, it's fine.
Oh, okay. Because one of the solutions is very easy to find. If you go out on the little dock area behind the kitchen of the scum bar, there's just a tangled mess of ropes. And I was like, do I need to do anything more to these ropes in order to make it the mop head? And you don't. And I think that's one very good thing this game does. Often there will be one extra step you need to do, but it never feels like it's one too many steps. And I was kind of expecting that throughout the game, but it never really hit me with the puzzles. Mm-hmm.
There were some random objects I picked up in the first act which later turned out to be other things you can use as the mop head. And I did wonder while playing it, think, like, what do I do with these? I haven't used this yet. But those items disappear once you're on the ship. So they don't make you carry them throughout the entire game as red herrings. So that's cool with them.
Yeah, chapter 4 of the Monkey Island 2 chapter is really when they give you a ton of items, but that's kind of the point of that chapter. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I mentioned this before. Maybe I did. We've been recording for a while, but there are no verbs, but some of the items in your inventory are really consistent and they kind of act as verbs, like the knife. Like the knife is kind of like its own verb used on many things. Like you'll end up using the knife on many things, the monocles on many things, the pen on a lot of things. It's kind of a cheat to get around not having verbs, but there are some consistent things you will use for several puzzles in this game.
Oh, and back to the mop, though. The way you get the handle of the mop, that seems to upset a lot of people, like a lot of fans, at least in the Reddit. They were like, that's just a step too far. Like, this felt too cruel to them. I thought it was hilarious.
Yes. There are some mazes in this game, but they're very simple. And just like in all the Monkey Island games, they're all like little tricks. And you have to find the mop tree to get a mop handle. And you could easily just break a branch off, but there's a extended cutscene where Guybrush basically like destroys this beautiful tree, and all the happy animals that are once around it are now just like sad and crying. And it is a big joke to show you, like, this is adventure game protagonists are destructive. They'll do anything for their own means, and we don't think about it as a player, but maybe seeing all the crying disturbed animals was too much for me too.
I don't know, I thought it was funny because Garbage is rarely that dumb. It felt like a real like Homer or Fry move for him to carve the entire tree and not just hack off a branch.
That is true. I think previous games might have made him too dumb, but this game, that might be the one instance where he was just a little too stupid and thinking, I have to whittle away the entire tree instead of just breaking off a branch. But it is like maximum destruction. Exactly. Maximum destruction is the MO of any adventure game protagonist. It's like, whatever I can destroy the most, that's the way I'll do what I'm doing. And yeah, a few other things I want to mention. It's like Elaine is in this game. And they have a very good relationship. I like the Elaine Guybrush thing and that they love each other, but it's not boring. And it's not like the angry wife kind of character she was in Curse and Escape. I think they went the wrong direction with that. And it was the 90s and that was kind of the humor at the time. But it's nice to see like a loving couple in a game when the jokes could be a lot easier to write if they weren't so loving with each other.
I really like their relationship. They're very positive and supportive of each other. I thought Elaine was kind of boring in this game, though. First of all, I was hoping we would get to play as Elaine in one section. It almost seemed like that in one of the preview clips before the game came out. It turned out to not be the case. She's off doing her own thing again, and she's very nice and sweet, but I almost feel like this happens a lot with female like love interest characters in cartoons. Like, say, on The Simpsons, you bring this up a lot when a guest actor plays a female love interest. They're afraid of like assigning any kind of negative traits to that character, so she just ends up being very bland. And Elaine in this game kind of felt that way to me. I think maybe a bit in Tails. She doesn't have to be mean like an Escape.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a bit, but it was still nice to see like a good relationship this kind of fiction when that normally isn't the case. But yeah, I mean, playing as her would have been fun for like a section or something, or learning more about her. But it's like she's so busy doing her own thing. And being a couple that was separated by a border, I do understand Guybrush being sad when she leaves and she has to do her own thing.
That's true. I love when he first runs into her. He says, I was hoping I'd run into you in the story, like a very meta thing to say. And then there's a bunch of dialogue options for parting ways after he runs into her in there. One of them is like, oh, okay, well, I'll let you get back to your work. And then she's like, oh, you say goodbye first. He's like, no, you say bye first. And you go through that back and forth. And then when she goes, okay, bye, he's just like so sad when she actually leaves. And he's always like,
yes,
excited to see her.
Yes, I felt that.
Yeah. He's always excited to see her, and he's always very sad to leave.
I mean, I'll be moving to Vancouver soon, but I have to say goodbye to you a lot, and I
that's
I felt
true.
That. So,
yeah.
Yes.
He's
so
still
don't,
a
I mean,
cool white guy.
I'm attached to the source material, so I can't see Elaine being boring. I'm just like, oh, they love each other, and it's so nice to see. We have to move on to chapter two, though, because chapter two, you get on the boat. I love this chapter so much. You're disguised as an undead swabby, and you basically have to solve all the puzzles within one little area with what you have. And just like in Monkey Island 1, you have to come up with the magic concoction in order for you to get to Monkey Island. But in this case, they've done all the work so far. You just need to get one item to drop in to make the concoction to go there.
Yeah, so even though I complain that this is too much of a retread of the first two games, at least they don't make you go through the pains of getting a map or collecting all the potion ingredients. It kind of reminds me of how in Dragon Ball, they bend over backwards to collect all the Dragon Balls, the titular Dragon Balls. But then in Dragon Ball Z, like they just recollect them over and over again. Like it's like nothing to them. That's what this felt like. It's like, okay, let's just go to Monkey Island and they can do it. Like, especially Elaine, she's like, oh, you made a potion to get here? I took this other way. She doesn't reveal what it is because that's a joke, but still.
Yeah, it turns out nobody ever needed the potion, but I did like this, and I liked all of the LeChuck crew members because it seems like they don't like LeChuck very much. There's this fun running commentary through the game as to like, why is Guybrush doing this? Why is he still doing this? And then even LeChuck's crew members are like, God, I really wish he was not so obsessed with this Monkey Island idea. We should be doing other stuff. So I think they might be doing a meta commentary on like people thinking like, oh, Ron Gilbert doing another Monkey Island game? Really? Can't he just make his own thing? But I do like the fun relationship because his crew members aren't just afraid of him like in past games. They're just like, this guy with his Monkey Island bullshit again. All right, let's figure it out. They really don't want to go.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the return of the lazy crew and having to get... convince everybody to vote to go to Monkey Island. That felt like having to get a vote from the crew in Tales of Monkey Island, and that was one of my favorite parts of that game. So it was cool to see that used here, because even though a lot of the puzzle and stuff felt like the first two games, this part felt like Tales.
Right, like a lot of the puzzles do feel similar in ways that I think might have been accidental, but the puzzles that seem similar are good puzzles that I would reuse. Like this one is really great because you need to get everyone to vote to go to Monkey Island, and everyone kind of needs one item to convince them based on what they're into, and they're all interdependent on each other, like any of these good puzzles. And what I like, I haven't mentioned this before, but like some puzzles are simpler than you think they would be, and that's kind of refreshing. Like one of the people on the ship lost faith in LeChuck, and she's like, yeah, I'm not going to vote. I have no faith in this organization anymore. And all you need to do is give her the pamphlet you got, the orientation pamphlet that you got, and that's it. That's all you need. And it's like, I kind of like that some puzzles are like, oh, there's one more thing you need to do. But a lot of them are like, no, it was as simple as giving someone the obvious item. We're not going to overcomplicate this. There's a few puzzles like that I think are really refreshing.
Halloween is almost here, and I'm going to be honest with you. It's well beyond time you retired that Nathan Drake costume of yours. For the past 10 years, you've just been going to parties as a regular-looking guy with sloppy shirt tails. No one's impressed. Now it's time to go back to the real classics by cutting a couple of eye holes in your bedsheets to be a ghost. But Jeremy, you say, I need those bedsheets for my bed. That's true, but your sheets are as old as your Nathan Drake costume. It's time for an upgrade to those, too, to something way better than the cheap cotton sheet your mom bought you for your freshman year in college. Treat yourself this Halloween to some sheets that aren't scary. Miracle Brand. The thing about standard sheets is that they soak up all the bacteria your body rubs against them overnight, which is both horrifying to think about and can have a real impact on your health. Miracle Brand sheets aren't just super comfortable to sleep on with a 500-count Supama cotton sateen weave, but they're infused with silver, you know, the shiny metal, which has bacteria-fighting properties. You'll still need to clean your sheets, you filthy animal, but Miracle Brand sheets prevent 99% of bacterial growth and stay fresher and cleaner between washes. And you can try today. Go to trymiracle.com/retro to try it out today. We've got a special deal for our listeners. Be sure to use our promo code RETRO, that's in all caps, at checkout to save 40% and get 3 free towels. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee.
So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. It's time to upgrade your sleep and your costume with Miracle Brand. Go to trymiracle.com/retro and use the code RETRO to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/retro in all caps. Thank you, Miracle Brand, for sponsoring this episode and our costume upgrades.
And I like the new characters on this ship too. Well, there's one returning character who is a Bob, who's called Apple Bob in this for some reason. I don't know why they added that there.
Was that always his name? I don't know.
Bob? Yeah, it was. He was in the first game.
Okay, I mean, no, Apple Bob. Was that always his name?
Oh. Yeah, I don't know why. Like, maybe they just felt they needed a bit of a flair to his name, because just plain Bob is too boring for them, I think.
And he is hanging upside down for most of for the entirety of the game, actually. But this is a very good chapter. I did enjoy this. And we have to move on to the next chapter. And one thing I wanted to note is that I noticed that some people were a bit disappointed in how some elements of the story didn't pay off. And I will agree with them there in that I was looking through my notes and it's like, oh, there's Captain Madison. She's the leader of the new pirate trio. And there's a lot of business between her and double-crossing LeChuck and her having her own spy on LeChuck's ship. And if you want any of that to pay off, it really, really doesn't. And I think a lot of people are disappointed in that. And that also, like, Captain Madison's influence on Melee Island, I thought there'd be more more done with that. But that's really just a thrown away line a few times in the beginning of the game. And it's like, oh, right, Captain Madison has a huge amount of influence over the island, but they really don't do much with that in the game.
Oh, speaking of, like, all the businesses being shut down on Melee Island really hit home. Because so many of my favorite businesses have been shutting down, and I'm sure you felt this too as well in Berkeley.
Yeah, it's not just because of the pandemic. It's just like, well, this business does not need to be in a building anymore. This can be an online thing, you know.
I wasn't thinking about in pandemic terms, though. I was thinking about gentrification in general.
Well, yeah, it's that too. It's just like any number of reasons, like economy, pandemic, the fact that like a lot of businesses are just online now, or online things are cutting into their profits. There's a bit of more melancholy to visiting Melee Island this time, just with so many things shut down.
And Wally is a little traitor, but then he pays for it.
Yes, yeah. But he one thing I do like, I don't want to go back to chapter one that often, but I do like that he now has a box of monocles. You could just take one instead of stealing his monocle and leaving him blind for the entire game. He's like, yeah, people are going to steal my monocle. I'm just going to offer them like little promotional monocles. So, yes, this game does retread a lot of territory. One thing I really like about it is that when you return to Monkey Island, when you actually go back there, it's not the most annoying part of the game like it was in the first game. Like, I love Monkey Island 1, but man, I don't like that section because getting around just takes so long. And I think the puzzles are a bit tedious compared to what preceded them in the game.
I think we probably talked about this when we talked about the first game, but I love the scale of Monkey Island when you get there. It just feels so huge, and you kind of lose some of that in this game. But the other previous games have done this already, like returning to Monkey Island, and it's the same every time. It's like, if you just feel so much smaller. I kind of miss how it felt going to Monkey Island the first time in the first game.
Yeah, it's like multiple maps, overhead maps, and Guybrush is like 3 pixels. You're steering him around. With the way they present the maps in this game, it's like everything fits on one screen, and Guybrush is like about an inch tall on your screen. He's not like 3 pixels that you can just make him go around the screen. So yeah, the sense of scale is different, but I think that does lend to a more playable game. It's easier to get around in this. And that this is a puzzle of threes. And you have the map, I believe. Is this how this works? Oh, yes. You have the real map. LeChuck has a fake one. And you need a bunch of info about LeChuck to decode the map in order to do this like ceremony to decode the map. And that's his catchphrase, his theme song, and his favorite food. And you get most of these by going back and forth between Monkey Island and LeChuck's ship. And yes, classic Ron Gilbert puzzle of threes. I did like this one. The song part of this is really neat because you have to basically pick up all the skulls you find and like place them all on pikes. And then Murray is the final one you place on the pike, and you have to play LeChuck's theme.
No, Murray's there to begin with.
He's there to begin with.
Yeah, and when you hit him, he says "fa," so that kind of gives you a hint as to what you're supposed to do.
Right. Yes. And that's the most fun part of it, just trying to figure that part out. But again, it's very, very intuitive. Like, you don't know how to read sheet music in order to solve the puzzle.
Here's a tip if you're speedrunning it. You only have to pick up 5 skulls because you don't have to pick up the last 2 skulls. You don't use those notes. And you don't even have to get the sheet music either. If you know the solution to the puzzle, you can just stick the skulls on there and play it. So I appreciate that.
Okay, yeah. I guess you don't need all the notes there.
Yeah, Guybrush doesn't say, like, oh, I don't know what to play. Like, I don't have the sheet music. It's like, no, if you know the solution, just go ahead and do it. Although, you can't get the catch. You do have to get LeChuck's diary to get the catchphrase. But it's on, like, it's random every time, but it's on the same page every time.
Yeah, and that's just the matter of, you just read all the new catchphrases he's coming up with, and then at the last page, he's like, I think I'll go back to what I did on Tuesday, or something like that.
Yeah, it's always on page 17. That's just another tip if you're speedrunning this.
But yeah, this chapter is fairly short, and I like how it makes the most tedious part of Monkey Island 1 fairly breezy and fun. There's a little maze, but like the forest maze, it's like you have to know 3 directions to go, and that's it. And it's fairly obvious based on the instructions you're given. But yeah, really nice. I really like this part. And this is when, obviously, you're double-crossed by Madison and the trio of pirates. Guybrush is horribly injured briefly, and LeChuck goes off because it turns out the secret of Monkey Island was always in the Voodoo Lady shop. That's what the real map that you decoded is pointing to, this treasure chest that you can see in her shop the second you walk in the game when you start playing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why in chapter 4 things get complicated, and that's true because this is the longest chapter. It's probably like a third of the game, I'm guessing, and this is the Monkey Island 2 style chapter. In Monkey Island 2, you had to get 4 pieces of a map, I believe. In this game, you have to get 5 keys for this giant chest in the Voodoo Lady's hut, or store, rather. And this is when you go to like a lot of little islands. There's a ton of puzzles. We can't go into all of them. But I really liked how this made the Monkey Island 2 kind of sense of design a lot more playable, a lot less frustrating, because I would get stuck. And then I would go, oh, I think I'll go back here. And then I'd usually find some new direction. And this was a time in the game where I would get stuck maybe like 20 minutes at a time, but I always found my way out of it. And if you're stuck on getting one key, but there's usually always another thing you can be working on or trying to figure out. So yeah, this I really like this part of the game.
This was the first time Guybrush was steering his own ship. He didn't have to like charter anybody to get around an island.
That's true. There's no crew. You actually, in the third chapter, you actually horribly rebuild the sea monkey that canonically you exploded in Monkey Island 1.
I kind of wish Scurvy Island and Terror Island were a bit more fleshed out. Like in Revenge, Booty Island had a lot of places to explore. And even like Fat Island, there's not a whole lot of different locations there, but at least the city, the port city part of it, you can walk around a bunch. In comparison, some of the locations in this game felt a bit sparse. But I guess that also helps you stay on track and not get too lost.
Yes, I do agree with you. If an area felt too shallow or like not enough locations, it ultimately led up to a more playable experience for me, because it's like, well, there are fewer things for me to check, and it doesn't feel like there's not enough to do in this chapter. Like if Terror Island had like 4 more locations, sure, it would be fun, but I liked that it was very brief and really it's just about like, well, here's a cave you can go into and figure your way out through this cave.
Well, I thought it was weird how Terror Island like, had a bunch of little locations, but there wasn't much to do in each spot. You just pick up an item and that was it.
Yeah. I mean, it was very, I like the atmosphere in Terror Island.
Yeah, I thought
but
that was cool.
I feel like, again, if these little islands were bigger, when I would be stuck for 20 minutes, it's like, okay, I have to visit like 8 locations in each island. This is going to be a pain. I think they were thinking of that too. Like, mm-hmm. How much do we need to give the player to do on each island? How many things can be available on each island? And there is so much to do in this fourth chapter, but again, like, all the puzzles work together so well. I like how so many are dependent on each other in very smart and interesting ways. The one puzzle I like the most, I think, is Bermuda is this, like, basically ice island. That's the pun, Bermuda. And you have to become the queen of Bermuda by beating the queen in three contests to earn the right to be queen. And by the way, the queen has a giant key in her crown, and that's one of the keys you need. And it's a very Ron Gilbert-y puzzle of threes. There's an eating contest. There's a, like, kind of a, basically like a staring contest. And there is a math contest. And I really liked how all these played out. And I did feel smart, even though they weren't incredibly challenging. I felt smart for figuring all these out.
Yep, I like Bermuda as well. It's a very different location. You don't expect to see, like, an icy, snowy island in a game like this. Odina, played by Jennifer Hale, who's very, very prolific voice actor. She did a good job. I kind of wish you could have talked to the people there. They just kind of, like, grumble. And there were, like, so many people I wish I could have talked to you and found out more lore about this island. But you don't really get much of that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, again, all of these senses of all the sense of economy in the game, it didn't lead to a worse game. And maybe does the writer's cut have any more to them?
No, I was actually really hoping that in the writer's cut, you could talk to these people. But no, they just kind of grumble at you.
Okay. I mean, I feel like there was enough people to talk to. Again, I don't want to repeat myself a million times. I never felt like there was a lack of content in this game. And I think Dave Grossman and Ron Gilbert were more into the mechanics instead of, you know, telling a story, because this is not really a story focused game. It's more about characters and the puzzles, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how did you feel about the scurvy deniers? That had to have been influenced by the pandemic, right?
Yes. You know what? It was minor enough for me to think it was clever. If this dominated the game, like the Aussie Mantrell stuff dominated Escape from Monkey Island, I would have been like, okay, this is too much. I get it. Mm-hmm. You guys are very clever, very nice. But yeah, there's a bit of a COVID denialism joke in this.
Especially because they hate science.
Yeah, they hate science, and you need to appeal to them through, like, crass commercialism in order to get them to eat limes. And it's about quarantine. It's definitely this could not have happened without COVID. It would still be a clever and funny idea if COVID never happened and they came up with this independently, because there were, you know, vaccine deniers before COVID, obviously, but they were not as in the news as they were post COVID. But yeah, I when I first ran into this, I was like, oh no, I don't want to be reminded of this. I don't want jokes about this. Not that I think the jokes are inappropriate. I just think they're very cringy. But it was fine. It was brief enough, and I think they realized, like, we're playing with fire here, and we think we're very clever. Let's just leave this to be a very brief section of the game.
Yeah, I'm glad it was, like, pretty much quarantined to that one quarantine ship. You don't keep running into scurvy deniers throughout the game or anything like that.
Yeah, and we were talking about the story of the game, and it like, just breaking it down, it's so simple. It's like, Guybrush needs to go to Monkey Island. Okay, he does. He gets on the truck ship. He goes there. Once he gets there, he realizes the secret is actually on Melee Island, so he goes back there. And then he's got to find five keys, and then he finds the five keys, and when he opens the chest to find the secret, it's actually a different chest is inside the chest, and he has to go back to Monkey Island to open the chest. That's the extent of the story. That's all that happens.
Mm-hmm. And one of the ways of getting the key is, like, a lot more simple than you would think. That's the one where the locksmith, who's a new character, her name is literally Locksmith, her grandmother had it, or her mother had it, and you have to go to court in order to get it, because she thinks it was destroyed. But no, you just go to the court and you say, hey, I need this key. And they're like, okay, here you go. And they give it to you. I was like, wow, that was surprisingly easy.
Yeah, it's another one of those cases where I thought, like, would it be this easy? And it was. And there's like two, that's one of two keys that are very easy to get. The other one is, it involves something you might have done before, in that if you're, like, when you're on LeChuck's ship, you can feed the chickens in the ship, and one of them poops after you feed it. When you come back to the room, you can see that it's pooped below. And when you revisit the ship later in the game in Chapter 4, you see that chicken has a key inside of it. And you're like, oh, is it as simple as feeding the chicken and leaving and coming back? And it is. So that key is relying on something you might have done in the past. And if you haven't, you can still experiment with the thing in the room, with one of the items in the room and the chicken.
And this is why I think everyone should play on hard mode, not casual, because in casual, it's those two keys are even easier to get. In casual mode, you go to a locksmith and say, hey, I heard your mother had the key. She's like, yep, and here it is. And she just hands it to you. You don't have to go to court or anything. Yes. And to get the key on LeChuck's ship, which is called Le Ship, which I enjoyed, you don't have to get, you don't have to find the chicken and get it to poop or anything like that. It's just like lying there and you just take it. No puzzle anywhere. So the puzzles are already like very player friendly enough. You don't have to like take away all the challenge, I think, unless you want to speedrun it, like I said. I don't think casual is really worth it.
Yeah, unless you just want to rush through it and get the characters and the story and the dialogue. But I think it might be unsatisfying because it does seem like it might be too easy. But I'm glad they give an option for like little kids or whatever if they want to play this and they're not smart enough to actually solve all these puzzles on
That's
their own.
True.
But again, Ron Gilbert designed games for children, so I think this is really an all ages game. There's one dam in the game at the end. That's really all I noted.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, LeChuck just says damn once, and I think that could be. I mean, I didn't go through all the dialogue because that would take like multiple playthroughs. But
yeah, I think Guybrush says it too.
I just
at one
counted
point.
One damn. Could be. It's I think it's an E for everyone game.
This is the act where Herman Toothrot comes back, and I'm pretty sure they retcon the whole being Elaine's grandfather thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ron Gilbert tweeted about that, and when Elaine meets up with Herman Toothrot, she's not like, Dad, what are you doing down here?
Yeah. God.
So, yeah.
I'm glad he's back to being
a
crazy old coot.
Here. Yeah. I mean, anything else about Chapter 4, I say this about every chapter. It's like, I really like this one. I really like that one. This one does feel the most classic Monkey Island to me, but in a modernized way.
In Act 1 and 4, those are the only acts that has a time-based puzzle. And that's the one at the museum, the lock display case. I'm glad it's the only one that has a time puzzle. And they give you lots and lots of time to figure out what to do.
Yeah, and they make it easy to reattempt the puzzle, too. Because, I mean, you play this if you're listening, but the parrots, you need to feed... The parrots are the alarm system. You need to feed them a cracker before you can open up the display case without them
game,
you know attacking
way.
You
so many
more birds than any other Monkey Island game. But in case you run out of time, and they give you a lot of time, by the way, to reattempt it, you just there as soon as you highlight the parrot, it's just like feed another cracker. You don't have to go into your inventory and drag a cracker out. It just includes that within the possible things you can do, which is not I think a few puzzles are like that. It's like, we know you're gonna try this again, you won't have to go into your inventory, here's the option.
Same with really unlocking nice. It you just like you don't have to take the key and put it on the lock or anything like that. They're just like, oh, you want to unlock this again? Just one click away. And I like that they give you almost a comical amount of time, because the guy is just like, well, just gotta fold this really nicely now. Gotta fold it very carefully. It's like, why are you taking this long to do this? I don't like that you have to see that cutscene every time of him noticing when the parrot starts squawking. But I guess if you can figure that out quickly anyway. What you're supposed to do there.
Yeah, it didn't bother me that much. I mean, if this was a Tim Schafer game, they probably wouldn't give you much time, then you wouldn't know if you were doing it the right way. I'm kidding. I don't actually like Tim Schafer's adventure games that much, I'm learning from doing this podcast series, although he's a fine man and I have no problems with him as a human being. But you were reading some review that was like, oh, it's missing Tim Schafer. And when I played this game, I didn't feel that at all. I feel
me
like
neither.
The sense of humor was the same. And I said this to you before the show, like, Dave Grossman does not get enough credit. Dave Grossman worked on so many great games. He worked on so many of the Telltale games that were very good. And he's back working on this, and it's designed by Ron and Dave. And I think Dave Grossman is better at designing adventure games than Ron than Tim Schafer. And I mean, that's why Tim Schafer does not design adventure games anymore. Not just because they weren't as commercially viable. I think that's not really his calling.
Yeah, but going back to the time puzzle thing, it's just so much better done than, say, the sushi boat puzzle and the rolling rock puzzle in Escape.
Yeah, or look at a better adventure game. Most of the puzzles in Full Throttle are timing-based. To the point where, we did a podcast about it, but to the point where it's like, am I doing this right or am I not doing it quick enough? And like, that was always a question with so many of the puzzles in that game, and that's why it kind of irritated me. And there's a few like that, even in Grim Fandango, that I didn't like. Future podcast, by the way, I'm putting it off.
Yeah, like I'm glad that there's only one, and the second one is just like that the same one, but with an extra element to make it a bit harder.
And we do have to wrap up fairly soon here, so we're going to move on to the fifth chapter, Beneath Monkey Island. Yes, it is a LeChuck showdown, but not in the way you think it is, because once you get in a certain area, you're really locked down, and it's all about solving, again, more puzzles of threes. But to cut to the chase here, we could talk about the puzzles if you want to, but to cut to the chase here, there is no final encounter with LeChuck. LeChuck and Guybrush barely meet face-to-face in this game. You can talk to LeChuck as the disguised Swabby, but there's not an ultimate confrontation. And that might be disappointing to some people, because LeChuck, he needs to go through this door at the center of Monkey Island. And once he does, you're left behind and you have to do the same thing. You have to solve the same puzzle he solves, but there's never an encounter with him at the end of the game.
First of all, I think Ron said that he wasn't allowed to murder anyone in this game or show a murder, which is why Captain Madison, I guess, is presumed killed, but they did it in a way where I thought she was going to come back, because it's like very, very loosely implied. But I think
her hat stays behind, I think?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's implied that Lila betrays her and kills her, but they don't actually show that. So I kind of miss that dark element from it, especially after coming off of Tales and seeing actual full-on murders in that. And I was someone who was disappointed by the lack of like a final confrontation with LeChuck. Like, I wish he just gave us the satisfaction of beating him while still keeping that same ending. Because Revenge also has the strange ending, which this game is implying, you know, is strange as a result of Boybrush and Chucky recreating it. But at least you get to defeat LeChuck before the weirdness happens. And in this one, you chase LeChuck through the final gate, and then all tension is dropped, because then the final twist of the game, or the story, rather, is revealed.
Yes, and we could talk about that in a second here. I think what they might be trying to say is that, like, Guybrush does not really care about LeChuck, and LeChuck does not really care about Guybrush. They're both driven to find the secret. And multiple times throughout the game, LeChuck is like, I could kill you, but I won't. I'd rather get to the secret before you, and you have to live with me getting it before you could touch it. So I think maybe that could be why there's never a confrontation, although I still would like to see one. And then we get to the ending, which Ron Gilbert being a little stinker in a way that I kind of like, because it did kind of hit me. Because you leave, you go through the same door LeChuck goes through. And I want to know all of our listeners what they think about this, the ones who finished the game, and I hope you finished it if you're listening this far, is that when you leave through the same door LeChuck has left through, you're now back on Melee Island for some reason. And it's a theme park version of Melee Island. And Stan works there, and he gives you the keys and tells you to shut down for the night. And Elaine is there too. And it's very, very strange, and you're not sure what's happening. And then you cut back to, a Boybrush, and he's like, well, that story doesn't make any sense. And Guybrush tells him basically, well, I think I chose to have Guybrush tell him, well, it's about the journey, not the destination. And there is a real, I mean, even if you don't like the ending, there's a very nice moment where Elaine comes to get Boybrush, and she's like, oh, I've got a new map. We're going to go on another adventure. And he's like, oh, I just want to sit here for a moment, and then, or something like that. And then the camera kind of lingers on him as he just sits and has like, I wouldn't say a wistful look, but that's kind of the way I read it. Mm-hmm. And then cut to black credits. And I did like that moment, like Guybrush kind of sitting and thinking and being wistful and thinking about what his life is like now and being happy. And yeah, I think that made up for the ending that I wasn't a huge fan of. It was all a theme park kind of thing, which Ron Gilbert has done before.
Yeah, in a way, this game had an emotional climax, and that made it satisfying enough, despite the lack of actual conversation with LeChuck. When it turned out to be a theme park at the end, I was like, okay, I see what they're doing here, especially when it turns out that Guybrush is kind of like the Ron Gilbert or the dev team talking to Boybrush, who is like the audience surrogate. And I like how I don't know if you did this, but there's like a plaque next to Elaine which you can read. Did you read the plaque?
I think so, but I don't remember what it said.
I wrote it down. It says, Historic Landmark, The Original Secret, a pirate adventure park established 1989 by R. Gilbert, which makes me wonder, like, was this actually the original twist at the end he was hoping to work towards, which he can't really use anymore because all these other games were made. So now the secret is whatever you want to make it out to be, I guess, is what he's implying.
Yes. No, I did like that touch. I'm conflicted about the ending because there's an emotional payoff at the end with adult Guybrush, older Guybrush on the bench at the end. I think it's very poignant and it works very well. Mm. At least it worked on me. But there's no narrative payoff at all, especially if you're expecting like, oh, Captain Madison and what happened to all the characters I like and what's LeChuck going to do? That all is irrelevant when you walk through that door. None of it matters anymore. Although, didn't you have fun up until that point with all those people? And I think Guybrush is right in that the secret could never live up to any of your expectations because they revealed the secret of Monkey Island and Curse of Monkey Island. It's already happened. The secret is it's a gate to hell, and that's the secret. You were already mm-hmm. told it. Even if they redefine it, could it be better than that? Could it be? I mean, it could be worse than that. But yeah, I feel like they painted themselves into a corner by just 30 years of buildup. They can't actually deliver a answer to that, which is satisfying. But they might have been able to deliver a narrative payoff that was satisfying that didn't necessarily answer that question.
Yeah, this is basically just Ron Gilbert telling us, look, I know I suck at endings, okay, but who cares? You still had fun, didn't you? And we did.
Yes. I made an exciting adventure game. I made a fun adventure game, and you enjoyed that. Don't let these last 2 minutes ruin it for you. So, I don't want to repeat myself, but yeah, emotionally, really rewarding. Like, I'm not going to say I cried, but I did get a little goosebumpy. And then after I finished the game, I watched the credits. It was great. It was weird seeing Walt Disney in the credits. I'm like, oh, right. I forgot about that.
Oh, I hated seeing
And then I went
that.
To the scrapbook. Yes, I went to the scrapbook and I was like, oh, I didn't read the scrapbook before I started playing the game, and I'm going through it and I'm like, oh, neat. They update the scrapbook as you play. And then once you finish the game, there's a little letter at the end. You have to keep pushing the button to break the wax seal. And this did make me very wistful and emotional. It's a letter mm-hmm. from Dave Grossman and Ron Gilbert saying, this is a time capsule. It's June of 2020. We're embarking on this. When we started Monkey Island, we were in our 20s and we had something to prove. And then Monkey Island 2 was, how do you make a sequel? That's what we were trying to explore. Now we're well into our 50s and we're returning to this. And what was it going to be? And I was like, boy, this is hitting me too. It's like these people who have had so many adventures in the past 30 years and not just in game design, in their life. And I'm also thinking like, June 2020 was an incredibly dark time to be alive. And there was some bit of hope in their lives by making this project. And that made me feel good too. So yeah, I feel like the 1-2 punch of the Guybrush silent ending and the letter at the end it really got to me. And it made any sort of lack of narrative payoff kind of irrelevant.
I don't want to keep bringing this up, but on the Reddit, it seems like a lot of fans interpreted the ending.
You need to stay away from that Reddit.
I know. I wanted to see the reactions. I was surprised by how negative people were about it. Maybe I should have been surprised because it's Reddit. But it was interesting to see because all the critic reviews were like very happy with this game. And then I went to the Reddit. I'm like, oh, shoot. People have lots of nitpicks about this. One of the things people on there took away from this is, oh, this just means all these other games we played are just Guybrush telling a story to his son that it just negates all of them. And it was like all by an unreliable narrator. And I thought, well, that doesn't necessarily mean none of this stuff happened though. Like you could take it as he was telling all these stories to his kid, but I think these things still happen to him.
Yeah, yeah. Like when you start the game and it's the big reveal, it's like, well, no, this is not really Guybrush as a little kid. He meets up with, adult Guybrush, and Guybrush is like, oh, were you acting out my Monkey Island 2 adventures? You always come up with the silliest ending. So mm-hmm. these adventures all happened, and Guybrush has told the stories to his son. And I think the scrapbook in the game is not just to let the player know, here's a reminder. It's also let them know, like, this all matters and this all counts. All of these things are valid. And this is something that's happening after all of these adventures.
Although now that we know that the ending of Monkey Island 2 was just Boybrush and his friend Chucky acting out the end of the story. We don't know what actually happened at the very end of that story, I guess. What truly happened.
That's for Return to Monkey Island 2 to answer. What other thoughts do you have about the ending, Nina?
A couple more things I wanted to point out. The three people who go through the gate at the end are LeChuck, Lila, and Guybrush. And they all resemble the kids at the beginning. Because there's Boybrush, Chucky, and Chucky's friend Dee Dee, who is a little Asian girl. So I think
I noticed that she looks like Lila, the pirate Lila, when I restarted the game.
And also, there is a secret faster way to end the game, which is also a Chivo. You can skip past this if you don't want to know. But at the very end, when you go through the gate, you find out you're in a theme park. You get the keys from Stan, which, by the way, you're not some random worker. You're a flooring inspector, which is a callback to the first game when the Outlook says
right.
You look more like a flooring inspector. You can take those keys, go back through the door, and leave the monkey head, and then it ends the game.
Cool. So there's sort of like a bad ending.
Sort of, yeah. And that's a way of another way of speedrunning the game. It's just ending it that way.
Okay. Any other final thoughts, Nina, before I give you my final thoughts?
I was trying to figure out in my head my rankings now that all these games are out. I'm kind of torn between Tails and Return as my third favorite. I think I might like Tails a bit more because Tails' story and settings are better, and I like how different the structure is compared to the other games. Like Return is really good, but it's just a little too nostalgia-based for my taste. And the meta ending was a bit unsatisfying, whereas Tails' ending felt like an ending. And it surprised me with how poignant it is, narratively, not just meta-wise. But then again, I'm also more moved by couple stuff than parent and child stuff, so maybe that's why. And also, Elaine does a lot more in Tails. So even though I think Return is mechanically a much better adventure game, Tails' story I like more, so I think they're tied in my head as my third favorite in the series.
Yeah, I guess rankings, I don't want to lay them out here, but again, like I said up front, Return is the best design game in the entire series. I think narratively, Tails might be my favorite, although it is building off of a lot of things that are written ahead of time. But yeah, I think in terms of puzzle design, it might be like Return, Curse, and then Tails. I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then 1-2 Escape.
Well, 2 is way down there for you, mechanically.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of. I mean, like, there is a huge drop between 2 and Escape.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say 2 in terms of puzzle design is 7 out of 10. Escape is like 2 out of 10 in terms of puzzle design, I think.
Okay. Well. I didn't think about ranking it like in terms of mechanics. So I'm not I'll have to stew on that for I think about that for a bit, I think. But in terms of like gameplay plus story, everything else, my ranking is Revenge, Secret, Tails and Return are tied, and then Curse, and then way, 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 way at the bottom is Escape.
Yeah. It's down in hell where it belongs.
Yes.
We really have to wrap up, though. I will say final thoughts as we hit hour two of this podcast that Ron Gilbert could do another one of these, I think, and maybe not be as reliant on nostalgia, although I think it's not super reliant, but it's part of the experience, and it can't help but be part of the experience because it's a guy returning to the series after 30 years. But the ending does not end with a tease, but Elaine's like, oh, we can go on another adventure. And it's just like, well, this is his life now. I'm like, can we see more of his life? And I think Ron can just, and Dave and whoever else, they can just make new adventure games. And hopefully this can be a successful game for them. And there might be a follow-up. Who knows? I can see that happening in a few years. There's been 6 of these, and I'm not sick of it. And I kind of want to see more, especially one design this well. And if Ron Gilbert doesn't make another Monkey Island game, he should make more adventure games because he's getting better and better at it.
Yeah.
He's like the guy. He's the guy. And future adventure games should take a look at this and what it does, because it's the best one I've played in terms of design, period, I think.
At the end of the Tails podcast, I said I'm satisfied with this as the last Monkey Island game. And then Return came out. And now I would like to see more Monkey Island games. Although, like I said at the end of Tails, I don't need to see more LeChuck. I'm kind of tired of it. I think all that has been done has been all that can be done has been done, which is why in this one they just bring him back without explaining why he came back, and he doesn't really do a whole lot. Really, I don't know. Like, can they do a Monkey Island game without LeChuck?
I think they'd have to find a new compelling villain, but Tales of Monkey Island, most of the game, LeChuck was not the villain, and I thought that was a fun subversion, mm-hmm. even though he eventually became the villain at the end. Maybe they could try something like that again, or like the son of LeChuck or something, who knows, but I trust them to make a fun game regardless of their creative choices.
I would like to see Ron Gilbert make more. It doesn't have to be Monkey Island. He could use this this system, the Dinky system, did you say?
Yeah, the Dinky engine.
Yeah, the Dinky engine. And make another one. And keep this art style, too. That's fine. Like, I want to see more from him.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if this is not the last we've seen of this engine. I feel like there will be some other uses for it, and I really hope there are. But we have to wrap up. It's been a long 2 hours, and I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast about Monkey Island. Hopefully, there'll be another Monkey Island podcast. Like I said, was not expecting to make a sixth podcast when I started this in 2019. And yeah, very, very satisfied, very happy. And again, please post in the comments what you thought about this game and this podcast, because I'm not seeing enough discussion about this game. And I hope people aren't avoiding it because they think it's a cheap cash-in or they need to be an adventure game fan to play it. I hope people are giving it a chance, and I hope it sells very well.
Also, it's only 25
Nina,
bucks. Enough of your never pay
yeah, come on.
More than 20 bucks for adventure game quips. Like, reverse inflation, 25 bucks. Was $11 back when the first game was released. And that's like nothing.
Yes, yes. And hey, you can afford it, but just don't cancel your Patreon subscription. We really need that. But yeah, let's talk about you, Nina. Number one, you got a lot going on. You're working for Fangamer. You have stuff going on in bookstores like the Spark series and other things. Like, you're even doing art for Riff Tracks now, some of their covers. Can you please talk about where we can find you and what you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Space Coyote. You can go to Space Coyote is Space Coyote with an L at the end instead of an E. SpaceCoyote.com. Go there to see my art. Go to SparksComic.com to learn about my children's graphic novel series, Sparks. You can go to Fangamer.com and sort by collection and click on my name to see all the video game merch I've designed.
Awesome. And as for me, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. This has been an episode of Retronauts, by the way. You can support us online by going to patreon.com/retronauts. You can get all of these podcasts 1 week ahead of time and ad free for $3 a month. For $5 a month is what we really recommend. You get that advanced podcast feature, but also access to 2 full-length episodes every month that aren't available on the free feed. And we've been doing that for, I think, nearly 3 complete years now. So there's quite a few podcasts, full-length podcasts, you haven't heard if you're not on the $5 level. And there is also a weekly column and podcast by Diamond Fight on that level as well. So a lot of content is waiting for you at the $5 level. If you sign up right now, you get access to all that immediately. And yeah, we think you'll like it. And also, since I'm releasing this podcast like 2 days after I record it, there we go. By the way, thank you very much to my editor who's doing me a huge favor by turning this around quickly. You can see me at Portland Retro Gaming Expo. There's going to be a promo in the feed in case you forget, but I'm going to be there Saturday at 11 a.m. for a Retronauts panel. So if you miss me at PAX, I'll be there with Jeremy and Gary Butterfield talking about fast food mascot games, or rather just food mascot games. It's going to be a fun video version of a discussion I've had before. It's going to be a lot of fun right before the lunching hour. It might make you hungry, but
I'll be there
time
too.
Just run across the streets. Nita will be there.
I'm not going to be on the panel.
The last
but
panel
I'll
gave me
there.
COVID. No.
Yeah.
The last panel gave me COVID, so don't get too close to me. I could be radioactive, but yes, that's all happening via Retronauts. As for other stuff I do, I'm part of the Talking Simpsons podcast as well. And you probably know about that. If not, it's a weekly podcast about The Simpsons. We go in chronological order. It's all happening wherever you find podcasts, or go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up there. $5 a month. We have a ton of miniseries podcasts waiting for you about things like The Critic, and Mission Hill. And we also have monthly episodes of both Talking Futurama and Talking of the Hill. And coming very soon, we're doing a new season of Blab About Batman, the animated series. That's only behind the $5 paywall, only at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. That's it for us this week. We'll see you again very soon for another episode of Retronauts. Take care.